said you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with two of the three co-authors of a new book that is coming out at Oxford University Press, or it's been released, called African Economic Development, Evidence, Theory, and Policy. I'm here with Christopher Kramer, who is a professor of political economy of development at SOAS. He's the vice chair of the Royal African Society, and he's also been very, very formidable in a South African group called APORDE, I believe is African Program for Rethinking Development Economics. He's had many, many wonderful books and writings. He's been a great inspiration to me. Today, for the first time, I'm meeting with his co-author, John Sender, who's a professor of emeritus at SOAS in London. And he was the director of the African Studies Center at Cambridge University in years past. Their third co-author, who is not with us today, Arkebe Okibe, who is a senior advisor to the prime minister with ministerial rank in Ethiopia, and has written many books and been involved in many things. I most recently remember Justin Lin and I sponsored a conference at Beijing University, and they had a book together. China, Africa, and Economic Transformation was the name of that one. But these are three very, very seasoned people. They've written a new book. There's a lot of issues and a lot of concern. Many people know the Commission on Global Economic Transformation at the Institute for New Economic Thinking is very, very focused on how all of the disruptions related to climate, technology, finance, and the very fabric of the nation state are causing a great deal of stress, and particularly in a country or a region that has a young population and a growing population, these stresses need to be managed. And we do have a report or a chapter of our five core chapters of the report on African development. At any rate, gentlemen, thank you for joining me today. Let's, in recognizing that we're amidst what I will call the unmasking of the pandemic, I'm curious how you see the world more generally, which is, what do you see? What do you find appalling? What do you wish you saw that you don't see? And what are you affirming? But I'd also, we will zoom in on your book. And after a little bit of how you see the book in the context of the challenges we face, I want to get to the origins. What inspired you to write this book, Here and Now? Anyway, why don't we start? Chris, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, great. On that question, on what inspired the book, Rob?
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, let's go there.
Well, I mean, first, just to say hello and thanks very much for having us on this.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
iNet podcast. It's great. There's a number of inspirations that between us, the two of us, might mention for this book. It comes out of years of teaching. It comes out of years of doing our own primary fieldwork-based research. And it also comes from work that we've done with senior officials, policy officials in different countries. But above all, there was a period when the three of us, that's John and myself, but also with Arkebe, who I wish could be with us today, but is unable to be, we ran over a period of 3 years or so a series of meetings, seminars, workshops with the former Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Haile Mariam Desalegn, were kind of closed-door sessions, very, very long and inspiring days and very, very rich conversations that we had. And it was really on the back of those that we felt impelled to draw together all the other work that we'd done and experience we'd had, and to try and to commit it to paper and put together this book. John, do you want to say something about our teaching background?
Yes, let me just add something to what you were saying about the closed door, rather secret meetings which we had with the former Ethiopian Prime Minister. I suppose there were many reasons why it was not felt to be a good idea to talk about them more widely, but one idea was quite important, and that was that there was a fear that if the US embassy, if the World Bank representative, and in particular if the British Department for International Development got to hear about the fact that the Prime Minister was studying economics with us and some of our colleagues, they would have been upset. They would have begun to say, we think we have better people to teach development economics than these people. We think the Prime Minister ought to study other things rather than the curriculum and reading set out by these people from the University of London, SOAS. And for that reason, because it was agreed between the Prime Minister and ourselves that the alternative views were to our own were expressed in many other fora, it was for that reason that we decided not to encourage all of these other powerful intellectual forces in economics in the world to intrude on these classes.
Well, I would guess, just from my own experience with INET and before, that there's a rather, what you might call, powerful anthropology and set of customs and so forth in that, what you might call, rival schools, compete for prominence, but don't really compete on the ideas and issues. In other words, they don't foment critical discourse. They try to, what you might call, seize the confidence of policymakers. And I'm curious how you see this book as stirring the drink, as shaking things up. I've read through the book, and many of the things about what you might call textured variety of policies and evidence and what you call possibilism. There's a way in which expertise often, what you might call, foments dread. So I'm curious, what is the flower that's blossoming in these pages?
I think that you mentioned some really important things there, Rob, about what we call the atmosphere that policy officials in Africa or elsewhere breathe, and that atmosphere is thick with all sorts of ideas and powerful forms of poison, some of them not so good for you perhaps. And I think you're right that there is a competition. It's often an uneven competition because some sources of ideas tend to be backed by much greater resources than others. And that leads to the reproduction of ideas through the ability to offer more scholarships, for example, to set down roots more in the way that economics is taught in African universities. So I think one of the things that we've tried to do in answer to your question is we've tried to write in a way that we hope gives policy officials and advisors across Africa greater confidence to question conventional wisdoms, to question the flapping at their ear, in sort of Jonathan Swift terms, I suppose, that's almost constant, that they get berated by international well-wishing advisors, by political factions domestically, etc., etc., and by intellectuals. So we try to instill confidence in challenging and questioning conventional wisdoms. Two ways in which I think we do that. One is we insist on the importance of taking evidence very seriously, and we might want to talk a little bit more about that. But the other is that I think we distinguish ourselves a little bit, I hope anyway, from many economists in the way that they write, by not only citing ourselves and our best friends, but citing people in the book that we disagree with very strongly. And we think it's important for people who read the book to be exposed to that range of views, that they will have a fairly clear sense of what we think and argue, but it's important also to cite. So we cite very radical economists, but we also cite IMF economists, World Bank economists, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And I see in some of the summary sections that you have been equally critical at both what you might call both outside of the range of the pendulum on the radical side as well as the orthodox side.
I think it's worth stressing, and I think we're quite proud of the fact that our bibliography is extraordinarily long. I think if you were to look at any other of the many, many books on economic development in Africa or development economics, they wouldn't begin to approximate what we've offered. And that really isn't out of a desire to show off or blow our own trumpet. It's out of a desire to do what's so rarely done, namely to present students with the full range of views and theories and evidence on particular policy issues. It is rare. It really is. It's not just there's a competition. It's that the competition, as Chris says, is uneven in terms of resources, but also because many of the economists, social scientists, policymakers don't play fair. They only expose their students or their audience to a limited range of the research, literature, and evidence that is available. I think what distinguishes our work, I hope what distinguishes our work, is that we do play fair.
I sensed, let me draw an analogy of my work and reading of the history of economic thought. I often find a great deal of tension between those people who are involved in what you might call the economics of innovation and those who are involved in the economics of allocation. When I go talk to people like Silicon Valley entrepreneurs and what have you, they don't act like they were doing intertemporal optimization. They act like they lived in a world of what we might call radical uncertainty, that we have to essentially have a vision to change the world that we don't know if it'll happen or how it's going to happen, and persevere and sometimes fail. Whereas the allocators are much more confident in their prescriptions and acting as though they're, quote, optimizing. And as I read your book, the sensitivity to evidence, the sensitivity to the nuance and diverse challenges within countries, and the, just given the absolute state of development and the rising demographics, the feeling that, which you might call pessimism and caution won't do. I don't know, you felt a lot more like Schumpeter's theory of economic development and my Silicon Valley types than what I'll call like the Aero de Brugge textbook theory of general equilibrium. Yeah. That improvisational, that grappling with the unknown unknowns, but the necessity to do so. The way in which you describe in the book how episodes often related to wars and famines, I know you cited Walter Scheidel's work about what are the, what you might call, profound catalysts to transformation. These are not optimization choices in a static system. So anyway, that's a long-winded vision statement, but I really found you're in many ways embarking on a new way of seeing development economics.
Rob, not long-winded at all. That's very clear, and I agree with a great deal of what you said. I would hope. I mean, I think that's right. I think we do try to have a bias towards being interested in production and what that really involves in the real world. And as you say, that takes place in a context of extraordinary uncertainty and improvisation. I'd emphasize a couple of more things about that. The improvisation that you talk about, the decision-making in a context of really, really profound uncertainty, affects producers, farmers, factory owners, investors, so on. But it also affects the decisions taken by policymakers. And as you say of producers, that they have to improvise and they sometimes fail, the same is true very much of policymakers. And I think that we explore quite a lot in the book the importance of not just learning by doing for production and for policymaking, but in policy design, but learning by failing. We have this analogy in the book to Enzo Ferrari, the motor racing innovator and businessman. And if you go to the Ferrari Museum outside Modena in Emilia-Romagna in Italy, you find at the end of the tour that there's an interesting sort of mock-up or photographs of the boardroom of Ferrari, where Enzo Ferrari had a cabinet, and it was the cabinet of errors, and it included all the spare parts, all the parts of cars that had broken down and malfunctioned, that had brought their races to an end prematurely. And then he would keep these in the boardroom and hold board meetings there so that everybody was always aware that they had to work out exactly what had gone wrong and have that failure always there to learn from. And so we sort of encourage policy officials in African governments to have an institutional equivalent of Ferrari's cabinet of errors, if you like. And I think, I mean, you mentioned Schumpeter, but perhaps one of the more important influences on the way we think about uncertainty, about imbalance and decision-making and learning in production and in policy from trial and error is the work of Albert Hirschman.
I went to graduate school at Princeton and I often got up to the Institute for Advanced Studies. Axel Leonhofer and Marcelo Dzeko used to take me up there because I was an unhappy economist. I guess that's why I run INET. Yeah. But Hirschman nurtured a lot of interesting thought. And I really enjoyed, by the way, Jeremy Edelman's biography of Albert Hirschman. I thought it gave a sense. And that notion that, as you're describing, comes back to mind from Edelman is how every time Hirschman seemed like he was conflicted or uncertain, he'd go back out into the field to learn, as opposed to try to, what I might call, deduce his way out of a dilemma and to redefine what was important. I thought he was a tremendous role model.
I think we all share this fantastic degree of admiration for Hirschman. And I think it sort of neatly encapsulates one of our central critiques of what many economists, development economists in Africa are forced to listen to. And that is the notion published by some of the most prestigious Nobel Prize winning economists in the world that Hirschman failed. And he failed because he didn't produce enough of his ideas in the form of rigorous mathematical models. And had he done so, he would have been much more successful in influencing policy. I think we won't want to argue against this, that view, and that's one of the things we're trying to do in the book.
A misplaced concreteness, huh? Let's talk a little bit. I mean, I remember there was a segment in the book where you, before you talked about possibilism, you said you got to, we're proving Hamlet wrong. What does that phrase mean? What are you suggesting there?
Which of us should take that on? Well, I mean, the idea of, I mean, this is again very much an idea, an intellectual reflex, comes from the debates between Hirschman and his brother-in-law, Coloni, who were really intrigued by this idea, you know, the role of Hamlet brought to a standstill by doubt. And their idea, I think, really is that not that you shouldn't have doubt, that doubt's really, really important, but that doubt can be a spur to action and to decisiveness. And I think that's, again, sort of where we come back to the importance of not just criticizing everything, but saying, well, look, if you challenge and question the foundations of and the evidence for conventional wisdoms, both on left and right, in advice to policymakers, that's not just a way of sort of settling in comfort in your armchair and saying, well, nobody understands anything. It's saying, well, look, that is where we start from. And there are actually constructive ways of thinking forward about what economic history tells us across African countries and elsewhere, and what a range of research and analyses tell us about what actually might be realistically feasible, and then constructing on the basis of that rather than coming to a standstill.
I'm just going to say the same thing, but in slightly different words. I don't know if I'll make it any clearer. Hamlet was sort of paralyzed. He didn't know. He wasn't sure. There were lots of things he thought he might, if he died, he might dream and it might be worse than being alive. He was paralyzed by things he didn't know. One of the things we're trying to suggest is that decisions have to be made in context of radical uncertainty. And the policy implication of that is not that you should wait until you're certain, but that you should act and be flexible and monitor the results of your action and collect data on what the impact and consequences of particular investments were and be prepared to change track because you've got good monitoring and you are flexible. So it's a Hirschman-like plea for the advantages of unevenness, of disequilibrium, a Hirschman-like argument against unbalanced growth. Against balanced growth and equilibrium, or optimizing in your terms. The optimal solution is clearly beyond any reasonable hope or possibility, even if it's theoretically coherent, and one shouldn't aim for it.
It's a little bit like, you know, another Hirschman idea, this idea of it's connected to this idea of the hiding hand, the principle of the hiding hand. There are many people who advise governments that they really shouldn't take on difficult, big projects and investments because they're bound to fail. They don't know enough. They don't have the existing capabilities for managing these complex undertakings, some enormous hydropower dam, some big oil from coal facility, whatever it may be, new industrial parks, and that they really better wait until they've got everything lined up and try very, very kind of modest initiatives instead. And in a way, the idea is the hiding hand idea is, well, sometimes things only really happen because of decision in the face of uncertainty and doubt. And of course you're going to get things wrong by that, but having begun the process, made the initial investment, committed to the initiative, you're then sort of forced, if you like, to monitor that and to learn from it and to actually learn how to do it better along the way.
It's worth perhaps emphasizing another key intellectual influence on all three of the authors of this book, and that is Alice Amsden, who said what Chris has just said, don't rely on the existing pattern of relative prices. Get the prices wrong. Make decisions which don't accord with your existing pattern of prices. Don't, as a South Korean nation, attempt to concentrate all your investment efforts on silkworm exports and silk exports, but rather be bold enough to imagine that heavy industrial production, a steel industry, a shipbuilding industry might be possible, which most orthodox economists said was a very, very bad idea for an economy like South Korea. And I think many economists have argued that the economic strategies followed in Ethiopia, particularly the huge investment push, public sector led, and the creation of industrial manufacturing firms, was bound to fail. Well, the jury's still out about whether or not it will fail.
When I want to put my own doubting Thomas on the table. When I am exposed to arguments about African development, particularly among investors in New York and so forth, the thing that seems to create the most dread is that what you might call as a byproduct of the history of colonialism, that the rampant corruption in government makes it almost impossible to introduce, implement, and sustain what you might call sustainable development policies, socially sustainable as well as environmentally. And so there's almost an impossibilism cloud related to the integrity of governance. And I remember I visited the Mo Ibrahim Foundation in Abidjan, their conference a year or so ago. There was a survey of how young people did not feel people in government were, which you might call, laying the plan for a prosperous future, and that the trust or faith in that goodness on the part of government was only represented affirmatively by 8% of those surveyed, of people under the age of 30. But I think, how would I say, as some portions of your book talk about, necessity is the mother of invention and necessity is upon us. How do we grapple with that? That resistance that comes from the fear of corruption in governance?
Yeah. Well, I suppose one way is exactly to encourage people not to sustain this absurd overgeneralizations about some mythical place called Africa, as though it's all the same. That's one side of it, and it is remarkable how those overgeneralizations persist. And another is, so to break that down and say, well, look, actually, if you look a bit more closely, you will see extraordinary variations between African countries over time. You'll see extraordinary variations within countries. Yeah, what's been happening in recent years in Lagos State in Nigeria is very different from what's been happening in some other parts of the country. and there are some extraordinary developments. People who only think in terms of these sort of rather tired cliches about Africa would only imagine that Angola is characterized by a political elite who do nothing other than take the oil rent. And yet, post-war in Angola, and through the throes of a kind of oil price boom, there was actually the beginnings of quite interesting diversification, the emergence of new Angolan capitalists in non-natural resource-rich sectors. You have to look beneath the overgeneralizations. The other side of that, Rob, is you know, when you talk about cronyism and corruption and people's loss of faith in government, it sort of reminds me that it's very important not to think in terms of African exceptionalism, because much of what you said is how I feel about my own government in the UK, for example.
I was going to say US as well. Yeah, how would I say? I've been ranting about what I call the commodification of social design in the United States, where, how would I say, Wall Street is created by the financial sector lobby, not by some broader base representative social design for a financial system. So such things are not exceptional, meaning unique to Africa by any means. And as you also stated, the variations within Africa are important to understand and comprehend.
There's also a theoretical question, I suppose, which is, I think one could interpret what you were saying about foreign direct investment in the following terms, that foreign direct investment will go to those developing countries or emerging markets in which there is relatively less corruption. I wonder if that begins to be empirically accurate. It's not clear that countries that have enjoyed foreign direct investment booms, such as, for example, Indonesia or China or Brazil, were very, very substantially free of corruption. As another colleague of ours at SOAS, University of London, Mushtaq Khan, has stressed over many years, there are different types of corruption, some of which are very facilitating of or complementary to rapid, productive, technological growth, rapid capitalist development. Other types of capitalism are far less so. And I think one has to not make generalizations about corruption, because sometimes corruption is not just necessary, but does seem to, it's not desirable in many ways, it's disgusting in many ways, but it's not incompatible with rather rapid technological change and capitalist development.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's kind of a nuance between corruption on the one hand, meaning the government officials doing something to get paid on the side to the, what you might call, while ostensibly representing people, and the other, which is the structure of incentives and subsidies and so forth that are conducive to business development, confidence, capital formation, or what have you. And obviously they can dance together, but I think it's important to be careful about what you call corrupt, is I guess what my suggestion is.
Of course, there's one other thing that's worth noting, especially I think this month when the World Bank has finally abandoned its ease of doing business indicator, and that is the empirical link between the sorts of things that some investors in Washington might regard as an index of a bad idea or a bad country in which to invest, the whole exercise has been shown to be arbitrary and not very scientific.
And bordering on corrupt.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we should raise the flag on that in this podcast. I'll ask you for people for some suggestions of people for me to interview in that realm. I think that's important to explore.
Sure.
In your as your concluding chapters, and you talk, I cited the Hamlet notion, but you start to talk about what to do. And while there's experimentation, generalization, variation, some of which are the things that you mentioned, I'm just curious, as I see the, how would I say, the recommendations following your exploration, including things like a high public investment ratio, not relying on small firms because the turnover and the amount of failures, but supporting large firms that can take advantage of economies of scale, being sensitive to balance of payments constraints. You guys take it from here. I found there's some very, very interesting what you call objectives that.
Let's try and do this concisely. I mean, I think it's difficult to do, but what we try to say is that we are not providing a blueprint. And that partly is for exactly things that you mentioned yourself, Rob, which is that uncertainty has a way of, sort of tearing up the best laid plans and so on. And also, who are we? You know, the contexts vary. Blueprints, people come along, they're a dime a dozen, and people come along with these things without thinking about context. Let me give you a story, an example I always try and remember to tell people, which is when I once was in Maputo. I was, I think, living in Maputo in Mozambique, and I had to go and meet a consultant who had never been to Mozambique before, and he was arriving to lead a team, and I was part of the team doing a study, I think, for the EU of their strategy for Mozambique. And this individual turned up. I met him, and we were driving into town, and I asked him whether he knew much about the history of Mozambique or not. And he said, "No, I don't, and I've never been, and it doesn't matter because we can use the Dominican model." And I was forever shocked and put off, and used that as a warning to myself to avoid trying to set down blueprints. But that said, we try to encourage people to think about some broad priorities for the design of what we call high yield variety policies, and they do start with high levels of publicly led investment, but in particular kinds of activity. So we would encourage officials to try and stimulate and engage in investment in particular economic activities, not necessarily sectors, but and that's for a complex reason, but it's because the boundaries between traditional economic sectors are blurring increasingly. But activities that have particular scope for economies of scale and scope, for generating foreign exchange earning, without which no growth process is going to be sustainable, and also with potential for generating jobs. And we have a particular focus on women's employment and activities that generate rapid rate of growth of female employment, for example, in rural areas. So for example, that leads us to think there is considerable scope in many African countries for greater investment in high-value agricultural exports. That's not by far the only kind of activity that meets those criteria, but very often it does meet those criteria. And as you've sort of hinted, So it's investment in particular kinds of activity. We think that a rapid rate of growth of both exports and imports is very, very important to sustained growth. We think a capacity, developing the capacity to monitor investments, particularly those secured on the back of state incentives, and depending on outcomes, to discipline people who are the beneficiaries of those incentives, if they don't actually produce the goods, is very, very important. And I'm just going to touch very briefly, maybe John can expand on this, on one final one, which is, we've been mentioning our influences quite a lot. Another very important intellectual influence throughout this book is Kaletsky. And from Kaletsky, we take a particular interest in the importance of a reliable supply, non-inflationary supply of basic wage goods, including food. So that means both promoting the production of food, but also managing prices in basic grains and food markets, which helps not only in terms of social protection, but also protecting profitability in investments in other sectors. That's my quick run through, John.
Well, pretty exhaustive, really, and exhausting, but perhaps just add one thing, and that is that the policy recommendations, if that's the right word, the policy discussion that we have at the end of the book is based very firmly on the theoretical chapters and the discussion of the literature about what holds back growth, what causes growth to stall, what are the determinants of investment, what are the various theories about how do you sustain high levels of investment, what's the evidence in support of theories of crowding out, that's to say that the public sector, if its investment occupies too large a proportion of total investment, it will reduce the available investment funds of for the use by the private sector. We discuss all the theoretical literature, in particular Kaletsky stroke Caldorian models of growth, and a variant of foreign exchange constrained growth, which a British economist called Tony Thirlwell worked on. And those, if you like, core theoretical chapters covering the determinants of investment, wage good and employment growth lead, we hope, logically to the sorts of things we're able to say about the key policy issues at the end of the book.
I'm quite inspired by the elements that you're talking about here in this notion that you called Objective 6, protecting welfare, profitability, and political stability in the grain market management. I just finished with my young scholars at INET, which is now approaching 1,600 members. We just did a 9-day rotating virtual plenary, and we asked many people for a series of questions to be asked. The name of the conference was New Economic Questions. And over the last couple of years, I've been working with a group on curriculum reform that are part of the team of Pope Francis at the Vatican. And so the Pope gave us three questions. And when I first read your objective number 6, I smiled because Pope's second question was, taking into account the administration of household goods requires its rules and its laws, what could be those laws to put the economy at the service of fragility? What should be the relationship between economics and politics? And what should it be like to ensure that everyone has what is necessary to live a fulfilling life. And that, which you might call sensitivity that you demonstrated to the notion of resilience and fragility, I cut and pasted that paragraph and I sent it back to the Pope's team saying that I thought you had friends, that they had friends, that there were people that were rising to that awareness. But I really think that's an important, and because you're talking about that improvisational dynamics, having things that lead to social rupture and unrest are not going to be contributing to what you might call the dynamic resilience of development. And I think it's a very important element that you brought forward. I think there are many things here that are both what I'll call diagnostic and prescriptive, that are, how do you say, there wasn't as much in your book that was novel as there was what you might call the integration and balance that I found how you put the pieces together to be very, very satisfying, and which I'll say somewhat more holistic and embedded in a context which is like the context that policymakers are actually grappling with. So I think you've made a huge contribution.
Well, thank you. It's very kind. I'd like to just make a slight plea in a very particular case for novelty, building on what we've just been saying about fragility. In the book, we argue that the poorest people in Africa and in rural Africa depend for their survival on wage income. In other words, not on what they produce, but on the wages that they receive. And it follows from that, if you accept our arguments and the evidence we advance, that what determines their welfare, their standard of living, their survival, their nutrition, is their real wages. And specifically, that will be influenced by the price of food, which is takes up 70% plus of their income, versus their cash income. And very often, they're in an extremely weak and vulnerable position. If the price of food spikes, they haven't got the sort of organized trade unions or lobbying power or even political clout to get compensating rises in money wages. So the issue of control of food grain prices is absolutely central to, if you like, the welfare prospects and maybe also willingness, the political stability of many African environments in a way that isn't recognized. People don't even collect data on real wages in much of Africa, and there's no systematic data collected by anyone on rural food grade prices, because the assumption is made, and it is just that, and it's an incorrect assumption, that it doesn't matter that much, because in rural Africa, people produce all the food they eat. Actually, they don't. They buy a very large proportion of the food they eat.
Just to add to that, Rob, and to also add my thanks for your very kind comments. I'm glad my good Catholic upbringing comes around in the circle again, and you've sent that to the Vatican. That's very sweet of you. But I would say that in bringing it back to what you asked us about at the beginning in terms of inspirations for this book, we told you a little bit about the privileged experiences we've had of working very closely with senior officials, including a former prime minister in Ethiopia. And John's been on presidential commissions in South Africa and so on. But we've also had possibly a bigger privilege, which is the privilege of spending many, many hours over the years doing rural field work and talking to people who are the people that you've really just been talking about, Rob. and learning something about their lives. And I think that is a quite important thing. Much of that field work, as John's just been touching on, particularly earlier on, was carried out in a context when people really didn't talk about labour markets in rural Africa because they simply didn't think that they existed in terms of wage labour markets. And I think having amongst us worked on that for a very, very long time helps to generate what I think John's right. I think that is something different in the argument and the evidence that underpins our confidence in some of our policies in this book.
No, I think that sensitivity from your field work is something that really, how would I say, you don't declare it, you do it in the book, meaning there's a kind of humility, but there's a consciousness that's infused in these pages. And I even remember, I think it was right towards the conclusion, you were talking about the different types of agriculture and poverty analysis and what you might call male-dominated capital-intensive versus what might call female-headed agricultural pursuits. And it was just abundantly evident to me how much what we might call institutional sensitivity that the three of you bring to the vision and to the explanations in this book. And I think I'm always, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, so I'm always prone to citing Marvin Gaye. But in the third verse, he's talking about the people who are, in the song, What's Going On? He's talking about these people that are the kind of outcasts or the rebels in society. In the first two, you know, he's pleading with his mother to bring some love in here today to his father. But in the third one, he says that they've got to bring, everybody thinks we're wrong, but who are they to judge us simply because our hair is long? Oh, you know, we've got to find a way to bring some understanding here today. And so I think the understanding, and like you mentioned, the way in which you cross the spectrum, integrating all the different thinkers, agreeing and disagreeing on both left and right. I don't think there's a wisp of dogmatism in your book. I think there's what you might call a generous exploration. And it's, I guess, more than anything that you said, my inclination in having us have this conversation was to illuminate the model of the way you enter the discourse and explain. And it was almost ironic at the end, you were talking about, I think, a Frank Sinatra model, and with my propensity towards music, about doing it my way. Some people who listen to that song find that there's a certain stridence, there's a certain frustration, but you don't impart that. But you do have a way, but your way has a big heart, and it's very magnetic. And I wish if there were more people writing like this in economics, I could probably go back to being a sailor and not feel compelled to run the Institute for New Economic.
Rob, a conversation with you has to come back to good music in the end, and that's very, very lovely things you say. I mean, just a sort of very, very brief thing. It really is marvelous some that you found those things in the book, and some reward for the effort in writing it. We've talked a lot about our theoretical influences, and I think what you're pointing to is important. And I think the reason for that is that the theory isn't enough and it's not nearly good enough. And what really, really matters is close observation, carefully, over quite a long period of time. And that's where we've been fortunate enough, the two of us in the research that we've done, and also Archeby in his own research and in his own observation as a policy official. It's astonishing watching him when he's doing that too. So I think that does infuse it.
Can I just say thanks very much, Rob, and from a particular point of view, and that is I have tendencies towards dogmatism and being too certain, appearing to be too certain about what I'm saying. And both Archeby and Chris controlled me, and I resented it at times. But hearing you say that we haven't got, that you appreciate the absence of dogmatism, makes me feel that my restraint was definitely worth it.
Well, I'll give you a song to listen to afterwards.
Okay.
It's Dionne Warwick, Gladys Knight, Stevie Wonder, and Elton John got together. And they did a celebration in a song called "That's What Friends Are For."
That's right.
And so you help each other, but you also help all of us and your friends to the world. I want to thank you both for joining me today. And I look forward to further conversations with you in the future as things unfold. And I look forward to the members of my Commission on Global Economic Transformation really engaging with your work and helping us be the best that we can be too.
It's an enormous pleasure, Rob. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Very good. We'll talk again soon. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.